This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Starts with a phone call. Ordinary. Domestic. Almost comforting. Placed by a man who had just stepped out of a nightmare he alone created. In a thin gray of an Idaho morning on November 13th of 2022, just hours after four students were slaughtered in their off-campus home, Brian Koberger did not call 911, a lawyer, even a friend, Cleo, the psychic from the 90s, because why not? Is Cleo
you
dead?
Just Cleo's invoked dead. Cleo?
Is Cleo? I think Cleo died, didn't she?
Yeah, she did, yeah.
Yeah, there was a doc about her. Anyway. He dialed his mother as Norman Bates, as Brian Koberger does. And once he had that line open, he kept going back to it again and again, like a swimmer clinging to the same rock in a fast black river. The times are clinical, almost cold in how precisely they map the mind trying to act normal. 6:13 a.m. First try to mother. And again, I'm going to pull everybody back for just one second. Because remember the old shower photo?
Well, he didn't have his mouth open.
He had one thumbs up. And
like, Mom, look what I did.
And I said forever, this is a nod to so many different things. Psycho number one, American Psycho number two with his clothes. Ted Bundy with the thumbs up. It was a lot. There's a lot of symbolism, I think, that Koberger throws out there because he thinks he's too smart for the room, but it's not hard to figure his shit out. The other one, I mean... Psycho, obviously, the Norman Bates thing, and Mother.
Yeah.
And the way he refers to his parents, as we're about to learn, a little creepy.
Oh, no.
Yeah, creepy. Little Norman Batesy. So, 6:13 a.m., the first try to Mother. No answer. Now, remember, who's calling their parents at 6:13 a.m. unless they're like in jail or somebody died or I don't know. I don't know. I don't know why you'd be calling your parents that early in the morning. And let me, I don't,
you're in the hospital with appendix pain.
Now,
and
I get them calling me at 6:13 in the morning because they're oblivious to anyone outside of themselves in terms of time of day. As they get older, it's like, well, we get up so early and why you're not. I'm not trying to rip on them, but it is funny because as your time shift and you get up earlier, you lose sense of where other people are. But anyway, 6:13 a.m. This is a 20-some-year-old man calling his mom at 6:13 a.m. on a Sunday morning. No answer. 6:14. Was it a Sunday? I don't know. I think it was a Sunday morning. I believe it was. If I'm off, I apologize. Anyway. I believe it was part of the weekend, 6:13 a.m., first friend and mother, no answer, 6:14 a.m., call to father. That's how it's listed in the phone. 6:17 a.m., then back to mother. So he's got an impulse. He's got to tell him something. He's got to make him proud.
Yeah.
But in a way, without revealing, he just slaughtered four people. But he's... go ahead.
That's what's really... I'm sitting here thinking, like, what would make me want to call my mom? Like, if I just did something that I was super proud of, especially at that time in the morning. Yeah. Like, mom, I can't wait to tell you what I did. But I kind of can't tell you what I did.
And it's Saturday morning, it's Sunday morning at 6:17. I'm really proud of what I did, but I can't tell you what I did or who I did.
Yeah, yeah, but I need to talk to you. We need to have a conversation. I need
Josh Groban was in town.
Hey, you know, I ain't broken.
Back to the mother.
Yes.
This time she picks up. 6:17. And they talk for 36 minutes. He's already home in Pullman by then, back in the apartment where he'll later take a mirror selfie. Just a few minutes later. You know that one? The prosecutors would brand as grotesquely cheerful for a man less than 2 hours removed from carnage. So this gives us a little bit of a perspective on where his mind was at that moment. He was amped up after he did this.
Mm-hmm. Like he had far too many energy drinks.
And he's calling mom and dad. He's in a good mood. He needs their affirmation because they're probably the only people in his world who've ever given him some sort of affirmation. Although it does show that in his college career, he did have some. I don't know. But obviously, these two are the ones in a world where nothing matters to Koberger. His parents' opinions do, it seems. His parents, there's something about that. That part is not broken. It's unhealthy to probably a crazy level. But it's not a broken connection there, as he is with everyone else on the planet.
Do you think he was always constantly looking for their approval? Do you think that would be part of it?
I don't think it's as simple as that, but in a simple way of saying it, yes. I think there's a lot more to it, but I think that's probably the simplest way of saying it.
Yeah.
What they said in that call remains private. What matters investigatively and psychologically is the fact of the call, who he wanted to hear, and how soon. Yeah. I mean, I'm just thinking to myself at 28. And... you know, I'm not someone who has a ton of friends in the world, honestly. I mean, I was friends with you at that age. But there's always like work friends. I have a very small circle of close friends. I really do. It's not big. So, I mean, I at 28 was closer with my parents than I am now. And so, I mean, I would call them about all sorts of stuff. And you know, sometimes it would be odd hours. Sometimes it'd be like, I don't know. It would be weird shit. You know, you're 20 and you're also kind of dumb because everyone's young and dumb. But
yeah.
But there's, I don't know. I mean, if you're tight with your parents to a certain extent and they're the people who've been there for you for the most part, I get the dynamic, but I feel like, I mean, it's very unhealthy, it seems here to an extent, a very big extent. And as you get to that age, honestly, I think I was more like 23, 24, maybe when that started to slow down. I think by 28, I was pretty much independent. I know. I mean, I was independent at 18. I left the house, but mentally where you're more over here than over there, I think by then I was way over there. But you know,
you were there early though.
I was there very early, but a lot of, that's not common though. I mean, a lot of people are not that. So, especially generations now, I mean, they're clinging to mom and dad, like way too late. I'm shocked sometimes. I'm like, I've never asked my parents for a dime after I was 18 years old. If I needed it or something, would they have given it? I'm sure they would have, but I mm-hmm. never have. They helped pay for a failed marriage. They helped pay for a failed wedding. That was fun. It was a good time by all. Anyway, by 8:03 a.m., he's on the phone with her again. So they just talked. They just talked at six something in the morning. And him and his Asperger'd up self. And look, I was going to say, you shouldn't say that like that. I can, because I'm on the spectrum too. So I can understand kind of some of this shit. Not like an I'm going to go kill four people sort of way, but kind of the compulsion sort of way, the urge sort of way of what, you know, this would make you feel this way or that way.
Yeah.
So look, I'm not saying it as an asshole. Most people who are, and there's a ton of people there, and this is just how your brain works. You want to share, and I want to be clear in how I'm phrasing this. You want to share your good news with the people you care about. And in Koberger's mind, this was good news. But I don't think he went out and said it. I just think he wanted to emote in some way, shape, or form where he felt like he was getting it out without actually getting the words out.
Yeah.
And that's where he was doing this, or why he was doing this. 54 minutes on the phone. Kind of talk that feels a commute, or in this case, a return to the crime scene. Location data shows his phone using towers. The cover King Road in Moscow around 9 a.m. Prosecutors later told the court he lingered there roughly 10 minutes. A few minutes after that, another call to his mother, about 9 or 10 minutes again. So this is where he's cruising around, checking out the scene, and on Bluetooth with mom? I don't know. Just as he left the neighborhood where the victim still lay undiscovered. I want to know what the hell was in that conversation, mom.
I mean, what does he say? I'm just tooling around on a Sunday morning. I just thought I'd give you a call. I'm just out driving. I mean,
you already know your son's weird. You already know your son's got something off about him. I don't know if this is parents that are, he needs us. This is all he has. We know that we're all he has. But you're not in any way thinking he could do this. I don't know. And in no way, I want to be clear on this. In no way am I trying to attack mom here or the parents. They're going through hell.
Yeah.
But there is a weird, 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 weird dynamic in this family.
What I want to know is, okay, at this time, they didn't know what had happened where he was.
Yeah.
But in the afternoon, maybe a day later, 2 days later, it hit the news. It hit the news hard. So they hear this and they're like, well, my son is
that. I don't know that they're thinking that way. I mean, have you seen dad?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what to say there. I'm not going to say anything mean, but have you seen dad? Have you seen the video? Have you watched Dad interact a little bit? Watch Dad interact a little bit and make your own judgments. Okay? In terms of...
Yeah.
I don't know anything. Seems like a nice guy. Seems like a genuinely nice guy that would take the shirt off of his back for anybody.
But Dad seems a little off.
Yeah. I don't know what else to say. We know nothing about Mom. We saw her come out of the courtroom. We have a picture of her coming out of the court with her bouffant hair, which is like, that I found to be a little odd as well. It's like, we're doing bouffant hair. Okay. As we're coming out at like.
What year is it? Are we at 2025?
I mean, it really, to me, it played more into the Norman Bates vibe of things. The sister looked completely normal. And I hate everybody's judging the sister. She's got the Koberger eyes. And it's like, look, if you're taking all these shots of this woman and you're going to catch her in a weird frame. It's if you're doing 60 frames a second, guess what? One frame's going to look fucking weird.
Yeah.
Guaranteed exactly. Of anybody. So it doesn't make any sense. I mean, she looks like a normal, I don't know. I mean, you're not judging normalcy by appearance. Koberger looks normal by appearance. But I had nothing out of her. I mean, I don't know. She's just trying to live her life. The fact that she's showing up there, I don't know what that says. I don't know that it says support either. I think it might say to her, she needs some closure in her life. And being there to witness this happen is what she needs. I don't know. I can't judge that. And their mere appearance does not, to me, also scream, we're supporting our son.
Right.
I mean, this is a big part of their life they didn't ask for. So they can do as they wish. They are also victims in this.
I was just going to say that, you know, they're different kind of victims, yeah. But their lives are upside down as well.
I mean, unless
Mom didn't ask for it.
Unless Mom's sitting there on the phone, you know, yeah, kill him. I'm sure she's not. That's insane. I mean, is there probably a level of like coddling or a level of not calling this kid out where he needed to be called out? Or maybe they tried it and it just didn't work, because with a mind like that, if you call it out, it doesn't respond, or it responds simply with violence, or it responds with something completely that you can't deal with. And if you're trying to keep a peace in a family with three kids, you kind of got to do what you got to do at some point in time. So I have a lot of empathy, but look, I am insanely curious about what the hell is going on here, because he's also talked with her an insane amount while he is in jail. And it's maybe it's just a mom giving her son support in a way that none of us can understand. I'm a father. If I knew my daughter did this, I'm sorry, I'm not on the phone with her.
But that's you. I mean, there may be other parents out there that no matter what my child does, I will love them, even if it's the most horrific thing I've ever seen in my life.
Nope. You're a broken person. Unless it's something like this, it's unconditional. Unless you start doing evil, 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 evil shit, and you are not repentant for it, and you're not any sort of sorry, I mean, none of that, the fuck do I need you for at that point?
Well, and this qualifies as evil. This isn't just I robbed a bank or
And that's why, look, I can't say how I would, I mean, and that's me having never experienced like anything like this, and I pray to God I never do. I can't imagine I would. But I can't imagine the Kobergers thought they would either, you know?
Yeah.
And then they're thrown into this hell and they're trying to work this all out. I mean, it's so easy for us to armchair quarterback. And I apologize when I do, because I know I can get into it. But it's like, at the end of the day, you don't know. You don't know.
You really don't.
And these no matter how they may have, we can say, if you parented them this way better, or parented them that way better, or this or that or whatever. Sure. But you know what? They only know what they know. And in the 80s and the 90s, I mean, there's information out there, and I'll tell you what, it changes every fucking decade on how to raise your children. There may have been too much coddling here. I could totally see that. That was a big thing. Children first. That was a huge thing. And it went to such an extreme that you have now adults that can't function in reality because they're first and they can't handle any sort of conflict. And you mix some sort of mental illness with that, or personality disorder, or whatever it may be with Koberger. And you get this. So, yeah. I mean, we all want to find a reason. At the end of the day, it's a very, very broken brain. The juxtaposition is gutting. A son chatting with his mom while just threading past the house, he just turned into a crime scene. He didn't stop there. A 2-minute touch base at 4:05 p.m. Then, as the reality of a homicide started to ripple publicly through Moscow, a long early evening talk with his mother again, lasting 96 minutes in total, more than 3 hours on the phone with her that day. This is just kind of getting weird and unhealthy. I'm sorry. Talk with my mom maybe an hour two maybe. Back in those days. Today, I don't know. 35 seconds. No, I'm kidding. No, we usually talk for a while. Me and my parents, we do like FaceTimes. But this, all in the same day, you're starting to rack up like a 6-hour convo with mom and dad.
That has to say that something happened. Something is wrong. Something. I had a pretty horrific. Nothing like this. But upheaval, 6 weeks ago, I think my longest conversation with somebody that I needed to talk to was 2 hours.
Sure.
Not six, but my life turned upside down.
I mean, but I guess here's the question, and here's what I'd love to know, is let's look at other phone records with Koberger and his parents, and is this a pattern? Do they talk like this normally? Because maybe they do. We do not know the answer to that question.
You're right.
They may always talk like this. It may be that kind of whatever the hell they got going on dynamic, that this is just how they communicate. If this is a spike in that chain, then you got something that you'd think or you'd hope maybe they'd be like, the hell's going on here?
Right.
Because it's a deviation in behavior. But if every week it's like, yeah, we're just up and down all the time, you can't tell a deviation because it's always chaos.
Maybe they sit and watch Wheel of Fortune together, you know, and that takes a half hour.
They might. This is one of the cases where Wheel of Fortune isn't in the story in some way, shape, or form. Do you know what I'm talking about? There are two other major cases where the main defendant has been a contestant on Wheel of Fortune with
Pat
Sajak.
Are you kidding me?
In the 90s, late 80s. Donna Adelson and Lori Daybell.
That's right. I knew about Lori. I didn't know about Donna.
Yeah.
Wow.
I was talking with Siobhan about this the other day, and God damn it, our interview we did, the audio didn't record, so we didn't get that. But
did you get video of her?
Well, we're gonna like lip read. what are you talking about? Are you talking about my interview?
Siobhan.
Well, a video, but there's no audio.
Oh, so it's just somebody going.
It's just us talking, but you can't hear. Yeah, so unfortunately, that whole interview just went to shit.
Gotcha.
But anyway, my point was we were talking about this. And I'll reiterate what I said last question here. What does it say that two of the major stories that we've been covering in the last 365 days involve defendants that both were contestants on Wheel of Fortune? That has to say something, because it's, you don't just like raise your hand and go, I'm going to be on Wheel of Fortune. Okay, well, let's set the date. There's conferences, there's seminars. You got to work your way up this shit. It's insane. It's like, it is a process to become they narrow you down. So the best of the best get on Wheel of Fortune. Because they don't want...
Is it kind of like...
It's like American Idol, but...
Where you just go through this process?
It's like American Idol, basically. But American Idol took their cue from Wheel of Fortune on how to do it. That's, you know, Wheel of Fortune was around way before that. So it's like that. It's just the best contestants. Who's going to be best on the show? Who has personality? Who's smart at this? Who can do this thing? So that's how they get Wheel of Fortune contestants. But at the same point in time... Someone who's going to be very, verbose on camera, confident, somewhat intelligent. And the characteristics that you kind of want in a game show character that's going to also be very personable back and forth to other characters, and not necessarily in a good way, but kind of in a I'm better than you sort of way, are narcissists. So... Look, if you are casting a game show, you want to cast narcissists on your show. And it's true. Look at all reality shows. It's all narcissists. Yeah. That's how you make a good television show. That's how they made game shows before they made reality shows. So, Lori Vallow-Daybell, Donna Adelson, I can't diagnose her, but, you know, that's what I'm saying. So there's that.
Interesting.
Yeah. Interesting little correlation, isn't it?
And I just randomly said Wheel of Fortune because I was trying to think of what game show pops into my head.
Yeah. Win, lose, or draw.
Jeopardy, but Wheel of Fortune. That would seem like, okay, Brian, as you're driving around, the puzzle is, let's see, we've got I and then a K, and then there's two spaces and then a D. What would that word be? I killed? I mean, can you imagine?
No. No. Do you know what her fucking puzzle was?
No.
Mischief Maker. Donna Adelson. Yeah.
You can't make this shit up.
You can't make this shit up.
And I have no idea. I didn't even know any of this. I knew about Lori because that came up in one of our segments, but I didn't know that about Donna.
I don't know what Lori's puzzle was, but I know, Mischief Maker.
Wow.
And she solved the puzzle.
Of course she did.
And then Pat goes over and talks to her a little bit, and she talks about the kids. Little Charlie. Little Wendy. And that one that got away, thank God. But he's just sitting there going, anyway, back to this case. What we know about the digital trail behind those conversations strips away any benign explanation that his phone died during the murders. It didn't. He turned it off at 2:54 a.m. and powered it back on at 4:48 a.m. A human finger pressing a button on a phone whose battery was full. Investigators called that a pretty awesome moment. Not with joy, but with the relief of clarity. Whatever story the defense might spin about strategizing or wandering in the night, you don't take sky photos with a powered off phone. The data made his intent plain. During the killings, he wanted to be digitally invisible. Afterward, he wanted to be, normal. That normal for him. It didn't include friends. Forensic review of the device found no text threads with anyone outside of family, no social orbit, no banter with classmates, virtually nothing except calls and a modest family group chat. The parents were saved formally as mother and father, capital M, capital F. When his mother missed a ring, he would ping his father, sometimes even texting in that oddly stiff cadence. Father, why did mother not respond? Question mark.
Are you serious that this is the verbiage that was used? Oh, boy. Oh, who calls their mother and father?
Me and Harper do as joking, as jokes.
Right, as jokes. But yeah, it's dad or mom or ma. I mean,
yeah,
mother, father. Yeah, you're not kidding about the Norman Bates.
Well, as they turn into teenagers, it's just...
Father, can I go out tonight? Okay, that's one thing.
No, like if I see my daughter, like, but we do it in jest where it's like, hello, daughter. Hello, father. And it's funny.
Yeah.
This isn't to be funny. This is like someone who is operating in such a mechanical manner that manner, where it's like a printing press almost. Like, what word would I put in this space to make this sentence make sense? I mean, that's a very, his brain is so, it's so different. It's not understandable by, I think, most sense.
Yeah.
This is not someone who's operating with a full deck at all in terms of how to respond and work within anything else. And I think they always knew it. His learned behavior is how he got by with life for so long, but then his weird urges and shit, I think, took over. It was not a fun, it was a very, very broken brain. And if you're the parents of that, I mean, that's heartbreaking. You don't realize how broken it is until something like this happens, I guess, because you're going to sit there and say, well, you know, he's off, whatever, he's autistic, and, you know, he's on the spectrum somewhere, and that's who he is, you know, but, you know, he's going to college, he's in his master's degree program, he's got skills that are going somewhere, and you're proud of that. He went that far without, as far as we knew, many problems. You know, he had his little stealing phase and heroin phase, but look, not a lot of people come back from that either, the way that Koberger did. So if you're the parents and you're experiencing that, and this kid came back from heroin addiction and theft and all this shit, and then he's like succeeding, as far as you know, and this happens, that's, you know, like finally, like takeoff. Oh, we got an emergency landing again. Oh, takeoff. Oh, we almost, oh, another one. Oh, I think we're on thin. We're going good. He's going good. And, you know, the plane explodes.
Falls out. Yeah.
The plane literally explodes. This all reads like a man who rehearses being a son, as if even his intimacy had to be formatted. And then there's the return, his drive back to the neighborhood around 9 a.m. in offender's impulse that investigators and profilers have seen before. Some go back out of curiosity, some to relive the thrill, some to make sure nothing incriminating was left behind. He did it while mid-conversation with his mother, traveling under the disguise of small talk. Was that cover, comfort, compartmentalization? Maybe all three? Cell data places his phone leaving Pullman around 9 and using resources covering the King Road address from 9:12 to 9:21 a.m. before heading back. And if you're trying to act like it's just a Sunday drive, nothing steadies the hand like a familiar voice in your ear. To understand the pull of that voice, you have to widen the frame on this family. When the headlines were fresh and the national glare was white hot, the Koberger family put out a carefully worded statement. Sorrow for the victims' families, cooperation with law enforcement, and a promise that as a family, we love and support our son and brother. That was not a defense. It was a declaration of bond, the kind that doesn't evaporate when the worst thing in the world happens, for some. For him, the bond ran both ways, backwards to childhood, forward to adulthood. Even at 28, he treated those early morning calls as routine. You can trace the outline of that closeness through the weeks after the murders, mid-December, with suspicion gathering and surveillance teams in the wind. He drove cross-country from Washington State to the Pocono Mountains in Pennsylvania with his father riding shotgun twice. Indiana cops pulled over the two for following too closely. Remember these? We've seen these videos.
Yeah.
Two bland traffic stops now preserved forever on body cam. Father answering small talk in a passenger seat. Again, watch the video. That's dad. Son leaning towards the trooper from behind the wheel. The optics are ordinary. A holiday road trip home. But ordinary is the point. Ordinary is the cloak. This is not to project guilt onto the parents. There's no evidence they knew anything. It's to note the pattern. When life tightened, when he needed a cover, when he wanted to be soothed or simply to appear soothed, he went to them. The forensic expert who examined his device said he sometimes started calling his mother as early as 4 a.m. on normal days. If that's your baseline, then the morning of the murders looks less like a panic response and more like a muscle memory. He did what he always did. He called mother. There's a harsher interpretation, too. Some offenders keep up the chatter with family after the crime, not for comfort, but for narrative control. If anyone later asks where you were, your phone can show a string of wholesome calls. Look, I was home. I was on the phone with my mother all morning talking about biscuits and who is going to be on Rachel Ray today? And did you watch the latest episode of Fixer Upper? Oh, my God. Did you see the way they put the shiplap on that house? Oh, my God. Oh, my God. The problems is that call logs don't travel alone anymore. They bring their friends' cell site records, GPS crumbs, Wi-Fi handshakes. The very call that might have served as a prop for innocence, dubbed as a homing beacon near the scene. And trying to look ordinary, he left a trail that looks anything but. There's also the matter of the mirror. Hours after the killings back in Pullman, he raised his phone and he took a selfie. That button-down shirt, earbuds, grin. The prosecutors would later try to fix in the jury's mind as arrogant and unbothered. Well, a potential jury's mind, anyway. It's a small artifact in a mountain of evidence, but it sits uneasily beside those calls. If he felt shame, it didn't leak into the lens. If he felt fear, it didn't ghost his voice long enough to keep him off the phone with his mother. What it does suggest is a man capable of flipping the switch from ferocity to performative normalcy without a visible tremor. By the time the legal machinery completed its long turn, change of venue, pretrial fights, a late plea to avoid death, his family's presence never quite left the frame. His mother and sister came to court. They shook and wept as sentence was passed. He didn't look back. The same man who could not start that November Sunday without talking to his mother left the courtroom in Boise without acknowledging her. If the morning phone calls were a bid to keep life together, the final silence was an admission that it had shattered. So what do those calls really say about the relationship? Start with attachment, not the warm, balanced kind that lets adult children separate and return as equals, but the other kind, the one that looks like dependence dressed up as ritual. The labeling of mother and father and early hour habits and ping-ponging between both parents. If one didn't answer, these are the fingerprints of a grown man who either couldn't or wouldn't build a circle beyond the family home base. His mother didn't pick up at 6:13 a.m. His message to his father landed like a child testing doors in a dark house. Is anyone awake? Can we get breakfast? Where is she? Why isn't she answering me? Layer it in normalization. After an extreme act, human beings often grope for the familiar. Coffee, a shower, a voice that knows you. Calling your mother after you commit a quadruple homicide is not the same as calling her after a tough exam or a night shift. But the brain can abuse the same pathway. Talk to mom, hear her cadence, borrow her normal to paper over your chaos. And when he rolled past King Road on the 8:03 a.m. call, he could have been balancing two realities at once. The illicit return to a scene only he knew was a tomb. And the banal soundtrack of an adult son morning phone call. Compartmentalization isn't just a trait in textbooks. It's a thing you can watch if you're looking in the right places. Add some calculation, and it's difficult to ignore that he turned his phone off before the killings. It's not impulsive, it's planned. And he turned the same phone into a machine of routine. Minutes later, calls to mother. Long talk at breakfast time, afternoon check-ins, evening marathon. It's also planned in a different way. Creates noise, it plants timestamps that look domestic. But the same digital universe that helps spin the routine also pins it down. The probable cause affidavit, dry as a ledger, lists the 9:12 to 9:21 a.m. coverage near King Road as clearly as a receipt. And if those calls were theater, the cell site data was a stagehand yanking up the curtain mid-scene. And consider identity. People who live heavily inside their heads, who curate a self for the outside world, will sometimes perform good son as a role. It's not that the love isn't real, it's that the role serves the function. The cross-country drive with dad becomes an alibi of presence. The morning calls become proof of stability. The family statement becomes a shield of respectability. We support him. We pray for the victims. We trust the process. Each brick is understandable. Together, they build a facade thick enough to muffle what's behind it. There's empathy due here, and it belongs to the parents. To love your child is not a crime. To pick up your phone at dawn is not complicity. The mother's presence at sentencing, shuddering, head in hands, reads like a woman drowning in two truths. The son she raised and the man the evidence revealed. If there is a cruelty specific to this kind of case, it is that the same closeness that once looked like family and family strength can, in hindsight, look like the rope he kept pulling at to steady himself after violence. That's not on her, it's on him. What remains then is the shape of a relationship through a keyhole of digital forensics, a man who meticulously hid his signal during the window of the murders, then flooded the line to his mother like a dam breaking, his son who, when his worst thing he'd ever done was still warm, reached not for confession, but for contact, a family that said they would love and support him even as they prayed daily for the children he took. Those truths can live in the same sentence without canceling each other out. They have to. If you're looking for a meaning in those calls, it may be this. He toggled between stealth and normalcy with disturbing ease, invisible. While the crime was in progress, Ordinary as soon as it was over. And that Ordinary traveled on a family line, one that had probably long comforted him. And yet, when accountability arrived, when the judge read out four consecutive life sentences and the gallery choked in grief, Ordinary finally failed him. He left without a word to the same mother whose voice he'd need most on the morning he killed. The line went dead. The rock in the river was out of reach. And nothing in the call log could change who he was by then. For all the unanswered questions in the case, the calls answered one. Who he chose when the mask had to be put back on over 3 hours with his mother on the day of the murders. A detour past the scene, whilst on the line, a phone that went dark at 2:54 a.m., then lit up with mother at 6:17, threads of routine woven through a morning that was anything but. In the end, that's the story of his relationship with his parents. As the evidence shows it, constant formal relied upon and ultimately powerless to stop when he already was. If there's a final image to hold, make it this. Two hands on a steering wheel, a voice through a speaker from a house three time zones away, and a street in Moscow, Idaho, rolling past the window like any other Sunday. On one side of the glass is the quiet voice of a mother, a tether to the simple and familiar. On the other is the house he'd turned into a tomb. Between them, a man who thought he could live both realities at once. The records say what his words don't. The calls, those small domestic calls, are the map. Tell me what you think in the comment section. On YouTube. And tell me what you think, Stacey. Right here. Right now. As we're sitting here. And you have a slide behind you. Do you ever go down that slide in the background by the chance?
It is. Yeah. Because when you don't want to take the stairs, you can just take the slide.
It looks fun. I got to put that in my house, actually.
I'm surprised you don't have one.
I'm working on a duck pin bowling alley right now.
Well, you have your priorities. Back to Koberger. My slide, my $1 million slide. This from the woman who was concerned that my showers were taking too long.
Yes. Anyway, yes. Back to Koberger.
Anywho, I need to know, and I said this to you before we started recording, I need to know more about this family. Yeah. It's none of our business, but I need to know more just as a curious
concerned
individual.
Citizen.
Yeah, like, I want to know. First of all, did they know that Brian was capable of such activity? Did they know that, you know, because we all have family members where you just kind of look at them at Thanksgiving and go, some shit's going to go down at some point with this person.
I mean, how do you know that anyone is capable of this unless they've actually done it, you know? I mean, I don't think that's even like a real question. I mean, unless they're like sitting there spouting it off, like, I'm going to go kill all these college girls. I mean, if he's doing that, then yes, you know, your son's capable of it. I don't think he was doing that, though.
But I wonder what the signs were, because I don't think somebody just wakes up and goes
quick to anger, hate towards women, really awkwardness, seeming to have no clue how to interact with other people, especially women. And very quick to anger when he's rejected. I can guarantee there's probably 500 people on this earth who saw him exhibit all of those behaviors at one point or another or collectively.
Did his sister?
Yes, I'm sure they did. But just because you witness it doesn't mean you can do anything about it. I've worked with people like that. I'm sure you probably have too. Yeah. And there's nothing you can do about it. It's not like, well, this person's probably going to end up like killing somebody at some point or some sort of horrible domestic violence towards a female, just judging by these traits, but you can't go and arrest them pre-crime. So I'm guessing there's a lot of people who thought, when they found out Koberger did this, that knew him, were like, yeah, saw that one coming.
Yeah.
I mean, it's horrible to say, but it's probably true. And what do you do? I mean, if that's your kid, I mean, I think they were trying to do everything they knew they possibly could do to try and support their kid. And maybe it was too fluff. Maybe it was too coddled. Maybe it was too this. Maybe it was too that. Who the hell knows? At the end of the day, I think his mind was just broken. I don't think there was anything anyone could do, quite honestly, that was going to change it.
Yeah.
I think maybe they allowed him to live 28 years of life with some sort of fluff until it finally broke. And had they not given him that fluff to keep himself moving forward, probably would have killed somebody at 18.
And again, that's what I want to know. Were there any close calls? Were there those moments of he's in a outrageous mood and it, you know, he's violent. He's doing all these things. Did they see something before where they just didn't know how to handle him because he was just off the rails?
Yeah.
You know,
I'm sure there were plenty of signs. I'm sure there's plenty of signs they can all look back on and go, yeah, I get it now. But none of them are going to be like, oh, if I just brought that to the police, because none of them could. You can't do anything. No. There's nothing they could have got. And look, I mean, trying to steer him this way, that way, nobody's going to try and steer their kids to go be a homicidal maniac.
No.
So however they steered him, it strengthened his screwed up beliefs or it weakened them. I don't know that they had that much of an influence either way. I think his brain was going to do what it was going to do. I think they tried their damnedest. I do feel bad for them. I don't think they're operating the Bates Motel. Was there maybe too close of a relationship there? Maybe, but with the mom and son. And I'm not saying anything weird like sexual or anything like that. I don't think that by any means. But was this like too coddling, too, you know, affirming to Brian's fucked up thinking? I don't know. At the end of the day, what do you do when you're the parent in that situation? Unless they're telling you, I'm going to go butcher up college kids, which I'm sure he's not doing. You're a parent. You're trying to be there for your kid, and you just probably don't know just how dark this kid is because he's never truly emoted it. And people like this, they compartmentalize things so deep and so far back that it's not surprising it didn't reach the surface and these parents were just as shocked.
Yeah.
That's how I feel. I mean, it's a weird family. It is. I mean, it's a weird dynamics, but weird doesn't mean bad. It's just, I don't know. Seems like
different than the norm.
Seems like an odd group of folks. And again, and I'm not saying that in a bad way. It's just odd group of folks. I don't know. I have no idea. But just from what I've observed, they just seem, I don't know. I don't know. And that's the thing. But in no way am I thinking that they in any way had anything to do with encouraging him to do something like this or enabling it or finding out he did it and covering it up. I think he used them for fuel, just as monsters do. They tap into other people and they use them for what will fill them up. Yeah,
there's a lot to learn about this family.
Yeah. And I think that's what it was. And yeah, it's got to be hell for them. Anyway, tell me what you think in the comment section. If you're not already there on YouTube, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi and find us there. Or you can also find us wherever you get podcasts. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi there to find us as well. All right. We appreciate all of that and your comments. Press subscribe. Until next time, for Stacy and myself, we will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only.
Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms. At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms. At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms. At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.